Now time for a catch-up on stories making headlines across the world. On this week's World Report with Justin McCarthy.
Good morning. On today's programme, Turkey comes to terms with 5 more years under President Erdogan and the isolated Russian-linked region of Transnistria. But first we go to Canada, which has been the focus of world attention this week over the hundreds of wildfires burning across the country. Nearly 8 million hectares of land has burned, with homes and buildings lost and tens of thousands of people forced to flee. Experts blame climate change for the hot, dry weather, and there are now calls for the government to establish a national disaster response agency. And smoke and haze from the fires has blanketed much of North America, increasing health risks. From Toronto, Dan Karpinchuk reports.
Unprecedented, terrifying, devastating. Those are some of the words being used to describe the wildfires literally raging across Canada. The summer hasn't even started yet, and already 2023 has become the 4th worst wildfire season on record. Alberta was the first to be hit as fires swept through northern regions of the province, bearing down on many communities. At one point, more than 17,000 people in Alberta were on the move, heading for urban centres to the south. One aggressive fire in particular was closing in on Fort Chippewa near Lake Athabasca, destroying homes and cabins and forcing the evacuation of several Indigenous communities. Firefighters from Alberta, the Yukon, British Columbia, and the United States were deployed to try to hold back the flames and to protect communities. Then the focus switched to Nova Scotia, at the other end of the country, where wildfires swept through parts of suburban Halifax, again forcing thousands of people from their homes. Residents describe having just enough time to gather a handful of personal possessions, clamber into their vehicles, and flee. That fire has since been contained, but another at the southwestern tip of the province was burning out of control. Officials say it's the worst in Nova Scotia's history. Meanwhile, Canada's firefighting resources are being strained to the limit, and more firefighting equipment and personnel began arriving from other countries to help. Attention then shifted to northern Quebec, where more than 140 wildfires started burning through the province's rich northern forests. Quebec had on hand fewer than 500 firefighters, and decisions were made to tackle only the most urgent and threatening of blazes. For the past week, smoke from the Quebec fires and others in northern Ontario began drifting south into the large urban areas, Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal, and the dense suburbs on the north shores of Lake Ontario, into the northern U.S., the New England states, Buffalo, Detroit, Philadelphia, Chicago, and New York City. There were smoke advisories warning people to limit their outdoor activities or stay indoors. The elderly and those with respiratory problems were most at risk. Many outdoor events were canceled. Air travel was disrupted out of New York and Philadelphia. Smoke and haze from the fires billowed further south into North Carolina and the Midwest. Over the past couple of days, the focus again shifted, this time to British Columbia, no stranger to wildfires. About 2,500 people were told to evacuate the community of Tumbler Ridge in the northeastern part of the province. That fire soon spread, becoming the second worst ever recorded in the province. Meanwhile, temperatures soared to more than 30 degrees Celsius, about 10 degrees above the seasonal average. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and several members of his cabinet began briefing Canadians on the wildfire situation. Trudeau thanked international partners who sent personnel and equipment and said more was needed. In Washington, President Joe Biden ordered the deployment of all available U.S. federal firefighting assets to help Canada. That includes about 600 firefighters as well as water bombers and other equipment. Over the past month, firefighters began arriving from the U.S., Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and France. More are coming from Spain, Portugal, and Mexico. And Canadian military personnel have been deployed by the hundreds to Alberta, Nova Scotia, and Quebec. Emergency Preparedness Minister Bill Blair says across the country there have been more than 2,400 wildfires. More than 400 are still burning, and of those, more than half are out of control. Millions of hectares of land has been burned, and more than 20,000 people have been displaced. Some experts say climate change is a big factor behind the wildfires. John Valiant is the author of the book Fire Weather, A True Story from a Hotter World. He's been watching the fires in Alberta, comparing them to a Category 5 hurricane, with flames close to 100 meters tall, combusting entire trees in a wall of flame, and releasing energy he says is borderline nuclear. He says over the past 20 years, Canada's boreal forests have changed dramatically, with heating, drying, and more CO2 in the atmosphere. Other scientists say, by almost any metric, wildfires are growing worse, burning larger areas, and burning more severely. Dave Phillips, a senior climatologist with Environment Canada, says there are three factors that he says are truly connected to climate change: rising sea levels, heat waves, and forest fires. Many say Canada's forests are the latest costly climate disaster. Experts say Canada needs its own national fire service, which could help prevent and put out fires across the country without relying on international aid. They say some fires move so quickly they can overwhelm provincial fire crews. They add that rapid response teams could put out fires quickly, preventing costly disasters. It's the old adage, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. What Canada needs now, and most of all, is a change in the weather, cooler temperatures, and rain. But that's unlikely. Forecasters say June will be mainly hot and dry across much of the country, and the summer has not even begun. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Next, we go to Turkey, where a very divided nation is settling down to another 5 years with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who dismayed the opposition by winning an election he was expected to lose. From Ankara, Jasper Mortimer reports.
Turkey has been through a tumultuous month. Today, 4 weeks ago, almost all the polls predicted that voters would end the 20-year rule of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. But in the election of May the 14th, Erdogan finished first, more than 4% ahead of his challenger, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. However, for the first time, Erdogan failed to surpass 50%. So the two candidates went head-to-head in a runoff 2 weeks later. During that time, Kılıçdaroğlu redoubled his efforts and lurched to the right in a frantic attempt to draw nationalists and conservatives away from Erdogan. He challenged Erdogan to a televised debate, but the president spurned him. When the second round took place on May the 28th, Erdogan won again, scoring a little above 52% to Kılıçdaroğlu's just under 48%. The president's supporters danced in the street outside the palace. They cruised along the boulevards in their cars, blaring their horns and waving Turkish flags from the windows. 8 days ago, Erdogan took the oath of office in parliament, but the opposition MPs expressed their contempt for the unfairness of the campaign. The monitoring group Reporters Sans Frontières had found that state television had given 60 times, 6-0, more airtime to Erdogan than to Kılıçdaroğlu. After Erdogan had finished swearing to uphold democracy and the Atatürk principles of secularism, his MPs stood in the chamber and applauded. Opposition MPs sat in their seats. No clapping from them. In the past weeks, Turks have found what it is like to have an economist as Minister of Finance instead of a political scientist. When Mehmet Şimşek gave his first press conference, he promised a return to rational policies. He meant that unlike his predecessor, he would not lower interest rates when inflation is high, nor would he empty the foreign exchange coffers to prop up an overvalued currency. The lira fell by 7% on Wednesday alone, and analysts predicted Şimşek would let it fall further until it found a level determined by the markets, not by Erdogan, who had allegedly given instructions to hold the lira below 20 to the dollar for election appearances. By Friday evening, one needed more than 23 lira to buy a dollar. The election showed Turkey is split down the middle. And on the opposition side of the country, the mood is somber. As the pollster Bekir Ardur put it, 48 out of every 100 people are troubled. They're troubled because they don't like Erdogan's authoritarian rule, his prosecuting critics for insulting the president, his closing down opposition media, his ignoring European Court of Human Rights criticisms of Turkish court judgments, and his making it less and less likely that Turkey will ever join the EU. And they are troubled because they don't understand how Erdogan won, particularly when the economy was in the doldrums. As the winner became clear on election night, a close friend turned away from the television screen and said to me, "Kılıçdaroğlu had creative ideas. Erdogan had no new ideas. This result cannot be explained." Something that makes me shake my head is how Erdogan retained the confidence of the people who suffered the earthquakes of February. In Adıyaman, for instance, the state disaster agency took 3 days to reach the city. People buried alive under the rubble died of cold because the rescue teams didn't pull them out quickly enough. Yet 69% of Adıyaman residents voted for Erdogan. What seems to have happened is that people didn't vote according to the issues. They voted for the leader with whom they identified culturally, the man who has made their conservative, traditional, headscarf-wearing style of life respectable. And for all his mistakes, the voters clearly thought more of Erdogan than they did of the mild-mannered Kılıçdaroğlu. But if the television coverage had been fair, if Erdogan had debated with Kılıçdaroğlu, an essential element of any normal election, the outcome might have been different. This is Jasper Mortimer for World Report in Ankara.
Finally, we go to Transnistria, a small breakaway region in Moldova, which has strong ties to Russia. Those links, following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, have meant the region is increasingly more isolated as the war continues. As Margaret Ward reports now from Transnistria.
How long are you here for? The border guard asks. Just a day, I say. He hands my passport back with a slip giving me permission to stay until 10:56 p.m. Transnistria has its own flag, its own currency and its own green and red number plates, but it's not a country. Even Russia doesn't officially recognise this breakaway region of Moldova wedged up against Ukraine. As the bus pulls off, I see my first Russian soldier, a young guy in summer uniform. He's part of a peacekeeping force established after the separatist conflict of the early 90s. Given everything that's happening in Ukraine, it's unsettling to say the least. Most of the troops are Russian passport holders recruited locally, some of whom are involved in guarding a large old Soviet arms dump. Driving into Tiraspol, the capital, is a trip back in time. Public buildings still have Soviet-era symbols. A tank and an eternal flame sit next to an Orthodox church. A cultural centre has the second biggest Lenin bust anywhere in the former Soviet Union. At least according to Tim, an American who has lived here for 15 years and guides tourists looking for a Soviet-era experience. At a nearby exchange, I swap my Moldovan lei for Transnistrian rubles, which have Catherine the Great on the banknotes and a hammer and sickle on the coins. We pop into one of the many Sheriff supermarkets. The same name is on most of the petrol stations, the Mercedes-Benz dealership and the football team. Sheriff Tiraspol famously beat Real Madrid in 2021. The oligarch who runs the group controls most of the economy, but UEFA no longer allows his team to play their home games here. Tim brings me to meet one of his mates, an ex-Soviet soldier called Alexander. We drive down a weed-covered laneway and stop at a ramshackle garage with a flag of independent Transnistria on the door. Alexander produces his threadbare uniform, along with a cap taken from an Afghan who he says was killed by one of his comrades. He says he doesn't like war. According to him, Putin isn't a very good guy, but nor are any of the others. He has brothers in Odessa in Ukraine, but he can't visit them anymore because he only has a Russian passport. After the anti-war talk, he offers me his ancient Kalashnikov and suggests I let off a few shots with blanks, but I pass. There were concerns when the war in Ukraine started that troops from here might attack Odessa, linking up with the main Russian army, or might attack Moldova itself. But Russian troops never got to Odessa, and the war has not been good for Transnistria. It has no functioning airport and has lost its land and sea links to Russia. Ukraine has closed its border, and Moldova no longer allows the peacekeepers to transit through its airport. Moldova and Transnistria are mutually dependent on each other when it comes to energy, but the political situation is frozen for now. Russia's foothold provides ample scope for interference, and it's a complicating factor for Moldova's EU accession. I jump into a bone-shaking minibus to head back to Moldova proper. From the turn-off to Castle Mimi, the road has been repaved. The EU has just promised Moldova more support to improve its economy. The minibus from Tiraspol is full of young people, many now pulled westwards by the new circumstances. I get chatting to Vlad, who's thinking of getting a Romanian passport so he can work in the EU. He says friends in Transnistria who work in Russia must now endure a 3-day bus journey to get there, avoiding Ukrainian territory. As the bright lights of Chisinau appear, Tiraspol seems even more stuck in its past. For World Report, this is Margaret Ward in Transnistria.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.